Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. It was July 3, 1778, almost 2 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence by the racially conscious founders of the American Republic. The foe was the multiracialist system of their day, the British Empire. The place was the rich and beautiful Wyoming Valley of eastern Pennsylvania, sparsely settled by pioneering farmers and their families. And coming down in force from New York to kill them was a band of British soldiers and a large number of Indians and half-breeds they had recruited with promises of plunder, more than 1,000 strong. The white American farmers there consisted at that time entirely of women, children, the disabled, and old men. The men of fighting age had all been called up by Washington's army and were engaged in distant battles. Some of these fighting men, just 25 in number, stationed in New Jersey at the time, got wind of the impending attack and returned to Wyoming just in time to lead the defense of their wives and children. The defenders of Wyoming numbered just 300 souls, including the returned soldiers, and were mostly elderly men and teenage boys. Ironically, the Indians and British on the one side and the white American farmers on the other were both led by men named Butler, both colonels. The Tory Butler was John Butler, loyal to the Empire, and willing to use savage non-whites to murder his own blood kindred if they refused to submit. And the American was Zebulon Butler, a man loyal to his own people. The British and Indians first made their presence known in the northwest extremity of the valley by murdering three white men who were working at a mill. And then they proceeded to burn one of the forts, Fort Jenkins, that the settlers had built to defend their farms. The 17 elderly men who manned the fort were no match for the 1,000 troops and savages arrayed against them. 4 men traveling to their work near Fort Jenkins, unaware that the invasion had begun, were killed. A young boy in their company hid among the undergrowth on a riverbank and survived to warn the whites farther south and east. The troops of the Patriots bravely assembled and marched on the invaders. They found the bodies of the men who had been killed and saw that they had been scalped and mutilated. According to the account by Milo Acker, who had spoken with family members of survivors, quote, "In the face of the overwhelming numbers of the enemy, the little army of 300 marched out of Forty Fort. Grandfathers took their muskets and stood side by side with grandsons in their teens. Nothing could have been more pitiable than the mustering of such troops, and dire was the necessity that compelled it." As the American troops approached Fort Wintermoots, they perceived it was in flames. But near the burning fort, both sides formed for battle. 5 companies were placed in crescent form, and Zebulon Butler said, "Men, yonder is the enemy. The fate of the Hardings tells us what we have to expect if we are defeated. We come to fight not only for liberty, but for life itself, and, what is dearer, to preserve our homes from conflagration, our women and children from the tomahawk. Stand firm at the first shock, and the Indians will give way, every man to his duty." Close quote. But the loyal white Americans were vastly outnumbered and outgunned, and despite their desperate bravery, they were forced to retreat. The Indian marksmen, armed with British weapons, deliberately shot the retreating whites in their thigh bones so they would be disabled and unable to fight back while being tortured, clubbed, and scalped by the hundreds. According to Acker, quote, "Many fugitives were lured by the promise of quarter to stay their flight, and then were put to torture too terrible to be described. Captain Bidlack was thrown upon a fire and held down with pitchforks while he burned. And as the shades of night fell, fires were lighted here and there, whose purpose was plainly proved by the odor of burning flesh, which sickened those who were so fortunate as to lie concealed. Among the most savage and relentless of the Indians was, alas, a woman, Queen Esther, as she was known, a half-breed who had lived in Philadelphia, and was supposed to be at least partially civilized and friendly to the whites. She held almost despotic power over her tribe and led them on to cruelties, each more ingenious than the other. Queen Esther's Rock is still pointed out, about which 16 or 18 men were forced to kneel, while this fiend in woman's shape danced slowly around the ring and crushed out their brains in turn, to the rhyme of a monotonous and blood-curdling death chant." Close quote. More than half the white force was killed that day. Quote, "Hardly a household but had lost father, son, or brother. From the house of a farmer named Weeks, 7 men went out, and not one returned. Next day, the aged owner was ordered by the Indians to decamp. 'How can I go?' he cried. 'You have killed all my family.' But they gave him 3 days' grace and then burned his house before his eyes. Many women and children who had been left in the forts on the east bank of the river, hearing from the fugitives of the dreadful massacre, fled at an instant's warning into the wilderness, hoping to reach the Delaware settlements 60 miles away. They fled alone or in twos or threes, though in one party there were 100, with only one man to help them. Behind them were the savages, before them the wilderness. Their sufferings were almost incredible, and the swamp through which the great body of the fugitives passed has been called until this day the Shades of Death. To the credit of the Tory Colonel Butler, let it be said at least that he was much agitated by the work of his Indian allies, and said in the presence of Daniel Ingersoll, his captive, 'It is not in my power to help it.' Neither was he able to control their greed. After the surrender of the valley, when he had promised that the property of the remaining settlers should be protected, in his very presence, Indians and squaws, with scalps hanging to their belts or brandished on long sticks, seized whatever took their fancy and destroyed what they did not care to take." Close quote. Even after the surrender and the departure of the Tory Colonel Butler, who claimed he could not control his Indian allies and who had apparently given up trying, the massacre continued. All those who did not escape were killed, and every farm was looted and then burned. One of the chiefs among the murderous Indian force was a man known to history as Joseph Brant, whose Indian name was Thayendanegea. He was rumored to be the half-breed son of a squaw and a British agent. Among his several wives was a white girl who had been captured as a child by savages and taught to go native. The survivors of the Wyoming massacre called him Monster Brant. Even after the massacre of the whites of the Wyoming Valley, he was lauded and honored by the British Empire. He traveled to Britain and was received with royal praise and approval. His portrait was painted by George Romney, Charles Wilson Peale, and Gilbert Stuart. The town of Brantford, Ontario, was named for him. Statues were erected in his honor. But the victory of Brant and his savages was short-lived. loyal white Americans, many of them Pennsylvanians and relatives of the murdered farmers, under the command of General George Washington, returned and ousted the murderous tribes from the Wyoming Valley. By their loyalty, they set the stage for the meteoric rise of European civilization on this continent. Even when circumstances were so dark as they were in the shades of death, victory was already on the horizon. Loyalty to our race and its incomparable civilization won the day over a corrupt empire and its savage mercenaries. We white Americans today can learn a lesson from the loyalty of the men and women who fought for the freedom and independence of their race and nation in the Wyoming Valley of Pennsylvania. What is loyalty? Loyalty is a natural quality, and for human life to continue, it is a necessary quality. Man is not a solitary creature. Though our race has a strong streak of independence and a need for space and freedom, we are still social beings, like it or not. The Jewish establishment knows that we have an individualist tendency, and like our other tendencies and weaknesses, they exploit that. Their promotion of radical individualism is one way to atomize us and make us weaker. It is only by virtue of organized society that the individual is able to exist. In simpler times, the isolated individual was unlikely to survive even one severe winter or an attack by an enemy tribe. He would have no one to assist him when he was sick or injured or otherwise threatened. He would be unable to implement even the simplest kind of division of labor, so his life would be not only short, but also brutish. The writer Martin Kerr taught us about concentric rings of loyalty that must be intact for us to live full lives and for us as a people to achieve our destiny. He inspired me to think on the concept. The first ring of loyalty is loyalty to oneself. Without this, there is nothing to give, including loyalty. The second ring is loyalty to one's family. Our families are the cells of our people's body. Without them, there is no future, no people, nothing. Even when our families do not understand the nature of our struggle, we mustn't give up on them. Be patient, be loving, be kind, be willing to do what it takes to show them by your words and by your actions and by your course through life that our cause is a just cause, the thing that matters most. The third ring of loyalty is loyalty to our nation. To us, this doesn't mean the false patriotism of the wavers of plastic flags. This means loyalty not to economic or political abstractions or to the criminals and aliens who now rule us, but to the people themselves, to the true descendants of those who pledged their lives to each other in what was then a wild new land called America. We are their great-grandchildren. We are their representatives. We are their life essence brought into the future. In a very real sense, we are they. We should stand together and do what is right for the next generation and correct the serious mistakes committed by the preceding generation. As modern America has ceased to be a true nation, united by common blood and heritage, and instead turning into a mere economic zone of the Jews' global plantation, a feeding and breeding ground for whatever cheap labor is needed at the moment, this loyalty assumes an ever greater importance. We mustn't confuse non-descendants of our people with descendants, even though they reside in America and mistakenly call themselves Americans. The Founding Fathers explicitly said this land was for their sacred posterity. Their posterity means their descendants, their children, and their close kin's children. When a Nigerian athlete enters the Olympics on the American team and is competing against, say, a Frenchman, which athlete represents us? Which one do we cheer for? When an all-white Russian team defeats a largely Negro team of so-called Americans, have we been defeated? These are questions of loyalty. The fourth ring of loyalty I see is loyalty to our race as a whole. This means that we recognize a greater loyalty than our narrow individual and family interests, greater even than our loyalty to the extended family of white Americans. It means we recognize our kinship with all the whites of Europe, from the Urals to the Mediterranean to the North Sea, and with the Europeans who colonized South Africa, parts of South America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and other areas of the world where our people have settled. These men and women are our kin, and their destiny is our destiny. There is still yet another outer ring of loyalty. The National Alliance, almost alone, recognizes this outermost ring, which goes beyond, far beyond, loyalty to the white race as it is presently incarnated. This loyalty can be expressed in several different ways. Dr. William Pierce would have called it loyalty to the life force. The ecologically minded might try to explain it to the layman as loyalty to this evolving planet in an ever-evolving universe, or, more correctly, as loyalty to life itself. You might also call it loyalty to the future. This means that we recognize that our race is part of a larger evolving whole. It means that we recognize that our race is more, far more, than just a biological entity, taking up space and eating and reproducing and trying to be happy as we live our lives and trying to make those lives as long and as trouble-free as possible. We recognize that we exist not only in the dimensions of space, but in the dimension of time as well, and that it is the future of our race, what our race has the potential to become, that holds promise beyond imagining. It means that we recognize that, led by the Jews and following their false values, present-day American society will kill the future of our race and lead us into the dead end of death and extinction via wars, catastrophes, and genetic decline. It means that we recognize that the future of this planet and life itself depend on our victory and the radical transformation of society which the Alliance embodies. This is loyalty to life. This is a higher loyalty to our race, not as an end in itself in its present state, but as an agent, the only possible agent of our future. The fifth ring of loyalty has always been the province of a small elite who understood the monumental implications of genetics and evolution. And so I come to the National Alliance. With the widespread destruction of true loyalty to nation and race by our enemies, we pursue our goal of reaching every single white woman and white man on this planet with our message of hope and inspiration. In this new dark age, the last three rings of loyalty appear to be gone. but as the scribes of the old Dark Age preserved the writings of classical times, so the third, fourth, and fifth rings of loyalty are kept alive for future generations by the Alliance. And we not only preserve those values and ideals, we live them. The work of the National Alliance is based on a full understanding of our position as a people and as a race, a full understanding of who we are and who is trying to destroy us. The National Alliance embodies the future. We have joined together in a new ring of loyalty, which embodies the old, but in an even stronger form, a new steel ring of loyalty to our race and to our race's future. These are dark days for freedom and self-determination. These are days of increasing repression, but these are also days of greatly increased opportunities for us. Hundreds of thousands, even millions of people on all sides of the political spectrum are coming to an understanding of the Jewish question. The more these rapacious vultures and professional fake victims demand obedience, the more people awaken and see them for the liars and parasites that they are. What do we face if we lose? Or if we take the coward's path of imagined safety and do nothing to stop the destruction of our race? If we fail to be loyal? In a third world future, we will face what the farmers of the Wyoming Valley faced, and what the farmers of South Africa and Zimbabwe are facing now. Be loyal. We can prevail. Unlike the forces of the empire, we are not motivated by money or plunder. We are motivated by ideals and by our very survival. As Albert Hubbard said, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of cleverness. We also need to be persistent. Ours is a task for people who will stay the course for decades, not months. Those who jump from project to project, from organization to organization, will have little permanent impact. It's easy to be discouraged. Our enemies have a great deal of money and the power that brings. But we have the truth on our side, and a passion that our divine spark will never be extinguished, and the knowledge that the fate of life in this universe depends on what we do today. We will never give up. Remember the words of the Roman poet Ovid. What is there harder than stone? And what is softer than water? Yet hard stones are hollowed out by soft and flowing water. Only persist, and you will overcome. When I think of William Pierce's devotion, persistence, and loyalty to our cause, and what he bequeathed to us who came after, I think of what John Wesley Crockett, the son of Davy Crockett, said after his father died at the Alamo. He is gone from among us, and is no more to be seen in the walks of men. But in his death, he slew more of his enemies than in all of life. Let's make Dr. Pierce's revolution come true in the hearts and minds of our people, and then we will remake the state. It will be a revolution of which Washington and Pierce would both be proud. A revolution worthy of the words of Francis Scott Key. A revolution which remembers the Wyoming massacre and the lessons it teaches. Stick to the task at hand, whatever comes. It is dark now, but the Jews cannot stop the sun from rising. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance. We need your support to keep this program on the air. Please help us by visiting natall.com and press the donate button. That's natall.com. Or write to the National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Those who contribute $20 or more per month will receive our print publication, the National Alliance Bulletin. Once again, that's natall.com, N-A-T-A-L-L.com, and press the donate button. Or write to National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to do right and fear no one.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout.